AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon in Washington. The search continues for the suspect wanted for killing five next-door neighbors in Texas. KHOU-TV reporter Grace White has the story.
The deadly violence started in the town of Cleveland, about 45 miles north of Houston, before midnight Friday. According to authorities, the family had asked the suspect to stop firing rounds just before the attack.
A gentleman stepped out of his house, said, "Hey, we're trying to keep an infant to bed." The man went back in the house. Next thing they know, he's walking up the driveway with the rifle in hand.
One of the victims was an 8-year-old child. Authorities say they recovered an AR-style weapon at the scene. Storms are heading up the East Coast today. Here's meteorologist Mark Chouinard.
So we've got some severe weather moving across Florida this morning, and then showers and thunderstorms moving across the southeast into the mid-Atlantic and then eventually into the northeast.
Outside the Washington Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C. last night.
We need to end all new fossil fuels right now.
Protesters with the group Climate Defiance demanding President Biden keep his word to end drilling on federal lands. The president was at the hotel to attend the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. 14 people are hospitalized after a roof collapsed at an off-campus house near Ohio State University. Fire Battalion Chief Steve Martin.
A few people that were trapped, I believe, were probably unpinned. It was like their leg was caught under some of the structure, and some of the other students lifted that off.
Authorities say the students were on the roof of the porch, which was not designed to hold a lot of weight. The rest of the house was not damaged. Fighting between rival military factions in Sudan has foreign nationals and Sudanese citizens rushing to leave. This man is among them.
A shortage of food, water, and power, so they start to invade homes.
Convoys have been making their way to the port of Sudan for evacuation to Saudi Arabia via ship. CBS is getting word a ship with American evacuees on board is not expected to arrive in Jeddah before tomorrow. Oakland, California is bracing for a possible teacher's strike. Ebony Perry has been teaching in the district for 20 years.
We have to send a big message to the district that we're not going to settle just for anything that you offer.
The union is seeking better pay and working hours, among other things. Rising the retirement age ignited a months-long firestorm of protests in France. CBS's Elaine Cobb has the latest from Paris.
French unions have called for a massive day of protests Monday. May 1st is traditionally a day of labor protests. This time, much of the focus will be on the unpopular pension reforms that start rolling in September.
This is CBS News.
Hire with minimal effort and maximum success with Indeed. Their powerful hiring platform makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com.
News brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, your personal injury attorneys with over 35 years of experience. GTWLawyers.com. They're all in to win.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The federal infrastructure law has been in effect for a year now. Community leaders around Wisconsin are optimistic about badly needed repairs and improvements. Here's Mike Moen.
At the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, Zach Brewing says so far nearly $3 billion in projects have been announced with funding from the law. Most are transportation related, and Brewing says it's badly needed as many areas have backlogs for priorities like road and bridge repairs.
And so by having a real strong federal partnership in the area of infrastructure helps address some of the backlog.
The law will also provide states funding for clean water infrastructure and expansion of high-speed internet. The plan did have some Republican opposition, but has otherwise been hailed by political analysts as a bipartisan achievement. Despite the significance of the law, some of those analysts say it hasn't stayed on the public's radar, especially during the recent election. But supporters are still getting the word out. Megan Rowe is with Opportunity Wisconsin, which has spent the last year educating communities about the benefits of these projects.
Whether we're spending less on car repairs due to updated roads and bridges, having access to safe drinking water, or improved mass transit opportunities, this law is a once-in-a-generation investment in our state's infrastructure and competitiveness.
And as more projects are announced, Rowe says it means additional well-paid union jobs for distressed areas. She says the long-term benefits from various improvements should particularly help rural areas and underserved communities. An interactive online map from the White House shows the projects so far are spread fairly evenly across Wisconsin. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
Accidents can be life-changing, no matter how careful you are. But with Gingras Thompson and Walks, you're not alone. For decades, they've been fighting for the rights of people just like you. They'll let you focus on your recovery while they handle the legal complexities. If you or a loved one has been hurt or killed due to someone else's negligence, contact them now. You may deserve compensation.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson and Walks, GTWLawyers.com.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at waukradio.com. You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning once again. This is Jim Santel, and it is Saturday, April 29th. Thank you so much once again for joining me in this, our second hour, our analysis, our discussion, our review of these important stories in law and government and the aspiration for justice in America, coming to you from the studios of WAUK in Waukesha, listening broadcast regions of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin, and always this hour, as in the past hour, taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. That phone number once again, 844-967-2789. Always interested in your questions, your comments, your objections, your observations on the topics of our days. Spending most of our time in that first hour and now into our second hour, talking about some of the major cases pending in the courts of America. Let's talk now about this civil matter pending in the federal court in Manhattan. This one is a case involving E. Jean Carroll and, yes, the former president of the United States of America, his name, Donald Trump. You know well, because we've chatted about this in the past, much in the news these days, E. Jean Carroll alleging not only defamation by the former president in his describing her as a liar in saying that she has made up an event, but also describing the event itself. In 1995 or 1996, according to E. Jean Carroll, the former president sexually assaulted her, raped her in a department store in Manhattan. And as a result of that and the involvement of a New York law that permits her to pursue a civil case, not a criminal case, but a civil case to revive effectively the claims, the charges that she has against the former president, this matter going to trial just beginning this past week. E. Jean Carroll on the stand as the plaintiff testifying. She does have the burden of proof. It is not a beyond a reasonable doubt burden. It's a preponderance of the evidence trial, a standard in this trial, because, again, it's a civil matter. And providing graphic testimony about what happened on this day in 1995 or 1996, this chance encounter that she describes she had with the former president that ultimately ends up with her and Donald Trump in one of the dressing rooms. And as she said, I am here because Donald Trump raped me. Now, Donald Trump has denied that. And again, in a civil matter, plainly he has a right to put on a defense, not obliged to do so, but a right to put on a defense. He is on a witness list, but nonetheless unclear whether or not he will come forward. We know that prior to some admonitions by the presiding judge, his name is Federal Judge Lewis Kaplan, that the former president was in fact commenting once again about the conduct of this trial. He had previously said that all this is made up, none of this is real, that she is lying about this, thus the defamation portion of the lawsuit, and denying again the underlying facts, maintaining that this is all fraud, perpetrated for the purpose of getting publicity to undermine perhaps his attempt to retake the White House in 2024. This past week, again, E. Jean Carroll herself on the stand, providing fairly compelling, plainly gut-wrenching testimony about what happened to her, again, back in 1995 or 1996, and now subject to cross-examination, which she necessarily is in our system of justice, by the attorney for the former president. His name is Joseph Tecapino. And he has been alleging that, of course, this is all made up in connection with his questions of Ms. Carroll about why she didn't scream, why this was not the subject of a huge hoopla at the time that it actually happened, and why there was not a response by people in the department store to it. She said, "I'm not a screamer." She said, "I was fighting. You can't beat up on me for not screaming." That's her response, a fairly compelling response to that. In the last few minutes of questioning in the defamation trial that was going ahead, this assault trial, Tecapino also asked Carroll about the dress that she wore on the day that she says that Trump raped her, again, back in the 1995-1996 time period. Now, Judge Lewis Kaplan had previously said that any questions, any matters related to DNA, about anything on a dress, on any clothing, would not be proper in the course of the trial. Nobody presents that information, he said, that done in response to a motion in limine, limiting evidence. So he tells everybody that is off limits. And Judge Kaplan, when, in fact, Tecapino begins to ask about the dress she wore, immediately dismissed the jury and then asked Mr. Tecapino about his intentions in this line of questioning, apparently expecting that he might, in fact, be treading into that close topic that the judge has previously told him he cannot go into. Beyond that, lots of other back and forth between Tecapino and the judge. The judge, again, Lewis Kaplan, stopping Tecapino many times, asking the lawyer to move quickly through his lines of inquiry to clarify his questions, moving through this. Again, also pursuing issues related to video surveillance and the lack thereof. Tecapino asking E. Jean Carroll about why there are not cameras, why there are not recorded information about this. And she said, "I've never been able to verify if there were cameras in the dressing room or in the lingerie department," which is where this happened. And after some back and forth, once again, Judge Kaplan tells Tecapino to move on. Again, the judge getting fairly frustrated with Tecapino in continuing to belabor this kind of thing. Judge Kaplan later admonished Tecapino. At one point, he actually said, "Look, you get to make a closing argument, and this isn't the time for it." Whenever you're on the receiving end of that kind of admonition, probably outside of the jury, it is not a good thing. It's not a good thing as a lawyer. So Tecapino obviously doing what he feels he needs to do to defend the former president, but not along the way abiding by, in many ways, the pretrial rulings of the judge, Lewis Kaplan, and testing the patience of the judge as this matter goes ahead. Also some focus on whether or not the questions are argumentative, likewise the subject of a back and forth between the judge and the attorney representing Donald Trump in this matter. Lots of back and forth during the course of this. And indeed, E. Jean Carroll going to take the stand once again on Monday morning as this resumes. The cross-examination will also resume on Monday morning. More of this, likely more testy exchanges between the judge and counsel for Trump. What else can we expect in this trial as it goes forward? Probably at least for days, if not weeks, beyond just the testimony of E. Jean Carroll. Well, we know as well that one of the other things that's going to happen is that at least two of the perhaps 20 people out there who have alleged over the course of many years that they had similar experiences with Donald Trump, similar sexual assaults, perhaps similar rapes at the hand of the former president, at least two of those women are going to come forward, according to the plaintiff's attorneys. They're going to come forward and testify to similar bad acts, similar kinds of things that happened to them, plainly supporting the notion that this was not just a one-off event, but that the former president, the future president at that time, was doing this with some horrific regularity. That's going to happen presumably down the road. And yes, indeed, also a part of this trial, likewise, a presentation of the infamous and influential Access Hollywood tape. Remember that tape? in which the then at that time future president talking to a reporter of Access Hollywood about his engagements with Hollywood stars. I'm not going to repeat on the air right now the things that he said, but nonetheless, we all recall what he said by any measure, inappropriate, gross statements about his behavior. The judge has indicated that that's going to come in, and the jury is going to be able to listen to what the defendant said about the way in which he engages with women. Yes, women in Hollywood, women in the public domain, but women generally, and the way in which he treats them and has treated them, also plainly relevant to whether or not E. Jean Carroll's allegations in this particular case hold water or not, and all that coming up. One of the other things, of course, that's going to be the subject of continuing cross-examination, as E. Jean Carroll herself has said, she can't identify with particularity the day, the month, even the year. She thinks it was 1995 or 1996 in which this happened. She says, I wish desperately that I could do so. And again, the kind of thing that's brought up during the course of a cross-examination. In the end, the jury, which is hearing all of this evidence, all this testimony, all the back and forth, will determine one day whether or not the defamation and perhaps more, even more significantly, the sexual assault lawsuit, a civil lawsuit now pending in federal court there, whether or not Ms. Carroll should receive a verdict in her favor down the road. Those among the major cases pending in the federal and the state courts of our land. Let's talk about a few other things happening out there in other proceedings of just this past week. Not in a federal court, a public federal court, but certainly in a grand jury. Again, right down the street from the White House, from the Supreme Court, and from the Capitol building itself. A major event, an unprecedented event, happened this past week when a former vice president of the United States of America, his name is Michael Pence, testified upon a subpoena of the U.S. Department of Justice to come and talk about what happened in the days and weeks before January 6th, on January 6th, and after January 6th. We know that Jack Smith, who is the special counsel in this matter, subpoenaed the former president to come and appear. And there were objections to that by the former president himself, raised the claim that the testimony of his vice president would be precluded under executive privilege, a position that was rejected by the federal judge overseeing the grand jury. And then we also had the claim by Pence himself that by virtue of something called the speech or debate clause in the Constitution, he should not be compelled to testify. And the judge in the end said, well, as to things that you may have said in connection actually in your role as the president of the Senate reviewing those votes on January 6th, that I'll agree with you on. But other things not in the well of the Congress, not doing the counting on that day, that I'm going to compel you to testify. And so indeed, just this past week, this past Thursday, a former vice president for the first time in our history testifying against his boss, his former boss, the former president, about what happened. Significant? Absolutely. Mike Pence plainly has a lot of information. These conversations, by all reports, very testy, very difficult between him and the former president before and especially on January 6th and afterwards as well. We don't know about the content of his testimony in particular, other than the fact that it happened, an unprecedented event in the rule of law in America. Right after the break, we're going to talk more about the rule of law here on Morning Cannolis. Join us for that discussion about North Carolina and Florida right after this break.
Hi, I'm Emily from Weichert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Home ownership is a big deal, and so is taking the leap into the buying or selling of any property. The Weichert team gets that, and our job is to help you navigate the sales process and provide smooth sailing. You have questions? We have answers. You have worries? We have solutions. Let us open the door to your future home. Weichert Realtors Lake Point, 608-721-8002, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weichert-lakepoint.com.
Hey, this is Lindsay Kindert at 540 WAUK The Shaw. At Civic Media, we love our local communities and want to share your stories. Submit your local event and we'll let our listeners know. Email me, Lindsay Kindert, at info@civicmedia.us. That's info@civicmedia.us.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
You've got questions about navigating the healthcare system? Kristen Lyerly helps us find answers and discusses other issues at the intersection of healthcare and politics. Hometown Health, Thursday mornings at 7:30 on Up North News Radio.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Here's your updated forecast on The Shaw. Scattered rain showers likely this afternoon, otherwise cloudy skies. Highs level off around 41. Winds out of the west, 10 to 15 miles an hour. Overcast tonight, a mixture of precipitation likely, lows around 33. A mixture of precipitation likely tomorrow, high of 42. A dusting of snow tonight through tomorrow. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 37 degrees.
WAUK 540 AM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
We are back here on Morning Cannolis, and we're spending some time in this segment of our second hour talking about other matters that have percolated up just this past week in the area of the rule of law, looking to the South, two states, North Carolina and Florida. Let's begin with Florida. We talked at the top of our morning broadcast today on Morning Cannolis about the Tree of Life prosecution going on in Pittsburgh. And the question before the jury there about whether or not to impose the death penalty. The Supreme Court, as I suspect many, if not all of you know, has said that under the Eighth Amendment, in precedent, that it is not cruel and unusual punishment for a state in its prerogative, its legislative decision making, to provide for the death penalty under certain circumstances. And again, there is a huge amount of litigation, a huge amount of presidential authority having to do with the circumstances and the rights and privileges and opportunities afforded defendants when they are facing the death penalty. Why? Because it plainly is the ultimate, the most extreme sanction a government can impose upon any one of its citizens. It is the ultimate penalty, and for that reason needs to be pursued and undertaken only under the most clear and convincing circumstances, under those circumstances where every single opportunity has been exhausted to establish, if indeed the evidence shows that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that all avenues, appellate avenues, opportunities for the exposure of inculpatory and also exculpatory evidence are presented, processes and procedures necessarily intended to ensure the rights of the defendant principally, but also of the people, to ensure that before this extreme penalty is imposed on anyone in America, that we've exhausted all opportunities. It is, as I said, the most significant thing that a government can do. And in states in the union, not in the state of Wisconsin, but in states in the union, you can, in fact, legislatively prescribe that for certain crimes, the death penalty will be imposed. Well, what has happened? What has happened in Florida just this past week? Well, just this past week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, we know him from many other matters, including something else we'll talk about in a future broadcast. That is this recent lawsuit brought by Disney against him, a civil lawsuit there. But in another setting, in another forum, Ron DeSantis, just this past Thursday, a couple of days ago, signed a major bill in the death penalty lexicon and jurisprudence of his state, stopping a unanimous jury requirement in death penalty sentencing. Up to now, for various reasons, a lot of procedure here, a lot of history here. In Florida, the rule, the requirement has been that before you can impose the death penalty, a jury has to be unanimous. Why is that? It's for just the reasons I explained, which is that before you impose that death penalty, you want 12 people to unanimously agree that this is something that we should, in fact, recommend, that should, in fact, be imposed because of the nature of the penalty itself. An extreme penalty, an available penalty under our Constitution, but unanimity, complete agreement among the jury required in the courts in Florida before you can impose that upon a particular defendant. Undeniably, all of this being done, that is the passing by the legislature, ending that unanimous jury requirement in Florida, all of it in response to the verdict that spared the life of a school shooter who killed 17 people. We know that well because in 2018 at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, students and teachers killed. We know that in the wake of that, the defendant in that particular case was spared. A divided 9-3 jury spared the Parkland Shooter School, his name is Nicholas Cruz, from execution in a verdict last year that did in fact outrage many people, outraged some victims' families. Others felt that it was an appropriate imposition of a penalty. And so Cruz, instead of being subjected to the death penalty, has received a life sentence there in Florida without the possibility of parole. He will never see the light of day. But in the wake of that, the legislature there passes this law. It went into effect as soon as the governor signed it a couple of days ago. It allows capital punishment in Florida with a jury recommendation of at least 8-4 in favor of execution. Again, it rescinds the unanimity requirement and instead substitutes just a recommendation that at least 8 members of the jury find in favor of execution. Significantly, doing a little research on this, only 3 states out of the 27 in our nation that impose the death penalty in some way do not require unanimity. Alabama allows a 10-2 decision, again, a split verdict among its juries there. And Missouri and Indiana let a judge decide when there is a divided jury. And so Florida becomes another state here that does not require unanimity in imposing the death penalty, again, in the wake of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas verdict and the imposition of a life without parole sentence as opposed to a criminal sentence, the death penalty imposed there. A movement important as our America continues to wrestle with this huge issue of the death penalty. Florida, under the direction of its legislature, the signature of Ron DeSantis, being another state now that does not require that this horrific, this huge decision to be made by a jury about whether or not to impose the death penalty no longer has to be unanimous. Simply 8-4 in favor of execution as a result of the law now changed in Florida. Let's again go then to North Carolina. North Carolina, another state, significant rule of law event just this past week. We have talked in this broadcast in the past about a case that's now pending in front of the United States Supreme Court called Moore versus Harper. Moore versus Harper, this case that comes up from the North Carolina Supreme Court that challenge a decision by a previous institution, a previous incarnation of the Supreme Court with respect to gerrymandering and the finding that the legislature had improperly drawn lines in that state. When we come back after this break, we're going to talk more about Moore versus Harper and something the North Carolina Supreme Court did just this past week that overrules a previous ruling and impacts the pendency of that lawsuit, that decision before the United States Supreme Court. Stay with us for that discussion right after this break.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. A suspect is still on the loose after a mass shooting at his neighbor's home in the city of Cleveland in Texas. KHOU-TV reporter Grace White has more.
Authorities in Texas say a man armed with an AR-style rifle shot and killed five neighbors, including an 8-year-old child. The San Jacinto County Sheriff says a manhunt for the 38-year-old suspect continued.
Strong storms continue today in the east. National Weather Service meteorologist Mark Chouinard has the forecast.
Heaviest rainfall today will actually probably be in New England, so portions of New Hampshire into western Maine. Could be looking at as much as 2 to 4 inches of rain there in spots.
Hundreds of Americans have evacuated from Sudan and will arrive by boat in Saudi Arabia. South African Jonathan Hainsworth passed through on his way home to Johannesburg.
The Saudi government came through and they were really, really kind to us.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
Accidents can be life-changing, no matter how careful you are. But with Gingras Thompson and Wachs, you're not alone. For decades, they've been fighting for the rights of people just like you. They'll let you focus on your recovery while they handle the legal complexities. If you or a loved one has been hurt or killed due to someone else's negligence, contact them now. You may deserve compensation.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson and
GTWLawyers.com. Hi, I'm Emily from Weichert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Your home, your property, your decision. At Weichert Realtors Lake Point, we'll guide you every step of the way, whether you're buying or selling a home or exploring commercial property. Your dream is within reach. You'll find our realtors love what they do, and more importantly, we think it's fun helping our clients achieve their goals. Who wouldn't want to do that every day? Give me a call at 608-721-8002. Weichert Realtors Lake Point, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weichert-lakepoint.com.
Ready for a journey to Flavortown? Head over to Roadhouse 66 Gas and Grill. They've been serving up the best food in Wrigleyville for 8 years and counting. From their famous smoked chicken wings to their tempura battered cheese curds, every bite is a trip to flavor heaven. And with hospitality that's second to none, you'll feel right at home. So why wait until after the game? Rev up your taste buds and join them at Roadhouse 66 Gas and Grill at 3478 North Clark Street in Chicago. Check out their menu on Facebook.
High pay with excellent benefits? Check. Fair treatment and safe work conditions? Check. A paid training program? Check. Check all of your career boxes with the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades of District Council 7. Experienced industrial painters and drywall finishers needed now or become an apprentice. Call Tom Coyne at 262-488-4839 today. 262-488-4839 or go to iupatdc7.com.
Consumers everywhere are loving the benefits of buying locally produced food. Not only is it fresher and more nutritious, it's also good for the local economy. With state-of-the-art facilities throughout the Midwest, the Village Hearth buns you already love are baked and delivered fresh daily to your local grocer. So whether you like unsliced old-fashioned hamburger and hot dog buns, or prefer classic white or wheat, just look for the familiar red Village Hearth logo on the package, and you've made the right choice. Village Hearth buns, locally baked and delivered fresh daily.
Every family has one. The Smother.
Holy why!
Hi, Erica! Okay.
This is my daughter. I baked her in my tummy.
The Goldbergs every weeknight.
Weeknights at 5 and 5:30 on My24.
With a house full of women, it's every man for himself.
What is it about hanging bras in the bathroom like Christmas ornaments? If I don't hang my underwear in the bathroom, that would be terrifying.
Tim Allen is the last man standing.
Weeknights at 6 and 6:30 on My24.
We are back for our next segment here at Morning Cannolis, right before the break, talking about North Carolina now. Another major event happening in its Supreme Court just this past week, affecting voting in North Carolina profoundly, deeply, and also affecting something pending right now before the United States Supreme Court. What is the history on this? Well, we know that in the past, the legislature there passed a set of lines, set of descriptions about how voting would take place in that state based upon the 2020 census. And in the wake of its decision, its drawing lines for not only congressional seats, but also assembly and Senate seats in North Carolina, a challenge to that based upon allegations of disenfranchising a significant number of people of color with respect to the lines and the ways that they were drawing. Cracking and packing is the way that gerrymandering is sometimes described. That case ultimately makes its way to the United States Supreme Court. And in a case, again, called Moore versus Harper, the Supreme Court has before it already entertained arguments last year on whether or not the decision by the North Carolina Supreme Court to throw out those lines, to get rid of those lines enacted, passed by the legislature, should be upheld or not, and whether the legislature should be directed to go back and start over. Along the way, another theory coming up from that case, this theory called the independent state legislature theory, that in fact, the courts have no role in any of this. We've talked about this at great length in the past. Moore versus Harper right now still pending before the United States Supreme Court and maybe still in line for a decision sometime soon. Well, what happened this past week is that in the wake of an election of last November, changing the composition of the North Carolina Supreme Court, the North Carolina Supreme Court once again took up this issue of whether or not the lines that had been drawn by the legislature were proper or not. And in particular, the North Carolina highest court, now reconstituted with a greater conservative as opposed to liberal a slant, if you will, has overruled the earlier decision in this congressional districting lawsuit. And along the way, in this opinion that was released just this past week, the majority of this high court in North Carolina said there is no judicially manageable standard by which to adjudicate partisan gerrymandering claims, and courts are not intended to meddle in policy matters. In other words, we're going to let the decisions by the legislature about the drawing of lines that arguably, according to the lawsuit, disenfranchise voters of color in that state. We're going to let those lines stand and let the voting go ahead with that, basically reversing the prior decision of that very same Supreme Court. That is not good news for the voting public of color and voting population of all North Carolinians in that state. It also, of course, implicates what's going on right now in the Supreme Court. And indeed, a few weeks ago, when there was every indication that the North Carolina Supreme Court would do this, the United States Supreme Court entertained briefs, solicited arguments from the parties on whether or not, if the Supreme Court reverses itself in the lower case, whether the United States Supreme Court should continue to hear the case. Highly likely now that in the wake of this decision by the North Carolina Supreme Court supporting the legislative line drawing that was challenged in the case before the Supreme Court, highly likely that the United States Supreme Court will now dismiss this matter on appeal, arguments being made on both sides on that issue, and not having to determine, therefore, whether or not the North Carolina lines at that level should be supported or rejected as the case is presently presented to the Supreme Court. And along the way, presumably carrying with it this issue about whether the independent state legislature theory, which is by everyone's account who has looked at this, a crazy theory not supported by any legitimate constitutional or jurisprudential issue, should also be thrown out. Likewise, that issue being swept along with the North Carolina decision. Again, the North Carolina Supreme Court this week rescinding its earlier opinion, finding nothing wrong with the lines being drawn, implicating, affecting what's happening before the United States Supreme Court. We'll see what the Supreme Court of the United States of America does. We'll see whether in North Carolina and in other places around our country, these matters continue to be litigated. They should be. They should be under the Voting Rights Act and other fundamental constitutional principles out there for access by all of us. Speaking of the United States Supreme Court, in our final segments this morning, turning now as promised to guns in America. We know that way back in 2008, for the first time in our nation's history, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Heller, H-E-L-L-E-R, found under the pen of a former associate justice named Antonin Scalia, a majority of the court at that time, for the first time in our history, finding that the Second Amendment, the language of the Second Amendment, contemplates and vests in the
position of all Americans, the right to possess and presumably use and own weapons in the home for self-defensive purposes. That was the first time in our history that a Supreme Court had identified in our Constitution, in the language of the Supreme Court, a constitutional right to own weapons in the home and use them for self-defensive purposes. Just last summer, adding on to that, in an opinion written by Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, yes, also the justice, the subject, the principal subject of all those ethics issues that we have talked about, Clarence Thomas writes a majority opinion in a case called Bruen, B-R-U-E-N, in which he expands that right, again, for the first time in our American history, expands that right to gun ownership and use to carry in public places, expands that right from the home into the highways and byways of America, giving people the right constitutionally, without government interference, to carry weapons in the public domain. All of that leading to our discussion this morning of guns in America. And as we think about remedies for what is plainly a dramatic, horrific problem that we have in this nation, a problem punctuated again just this morning as the shooter of five people, apparently someone who had an AR-15, this automatic weapon, killed five people in Cleveland, Texas, just north of Houston. He is still out there on the loose. He is being pursued by law enforcement. This mass shooting joins many, many others in America. We have had about 160 mass shootings to date in this year alone. What is a mass shooting? A mass shooting is defined, again, not arbitrarily, but by most groups out there, as being a situation where four or more people are shot. Not necessarily killed, but shot. Four or more people shot in an incident. That qualifies as a mass shooting. And under that definition, of course, that's where we get the 160 figure. Over 160 mass shootings in America to date. Over the period of the past 5 years, we've had about an average of 600 of those a year. That averages out to be somewhere right around two a day. Again, plainly, the media and generally journalism does not report on all of those, but we have got a huge, huge, terrible problem in America with respect to guns. It is a healthcare problem. It is a violence problem. It is a safety problem, a security problem. About 50 people are killed by firearms, not just in mass shootings, every single day in America. 50 people are killed every single day in the United States of America. In 2021 alone, 48,830 people in our nation died from gun-related injuries in 2021. It is estimated that today there are 393 million guns in America owned legitimately, perhaps some illegitimately, unlawfully, by people in America. 393 million guns in America. A recent, reliable, credible academic study indicated that about 1 in 20 people in our nation own an automatic or semi-automatic weapon, including an AR-15 of the sort that visited this latest violence in Texas just this morning. Major, major events of our recent history, the most significant big ones out there, the worst mass shootings in our history, Las Vegas, 2017. Remember that well. 50 people killed in that horrific mass shooting, 500 wounded. 2016 at the Pulse nightclub, Virginia Tech, 2007, and Sandy Hook, of course, 2012. Many, many others, once again, that mark, that characterize this ugly, terrible, embarrassing, and tragic history in America involving guns. Now, again, under the Supreme Court rulings, is there an eligibility? Is there a right to possess weapons? Yes, indeed. That's what our Supreme Court has said in Heller and Bruen. Significantly, that same Supreme Court in Heller has said this, again, from the pen of Antonin Scalia, repeated in the opinions of Justice Brett Kavanaugh and the Chief Justice of the United States of America, John Roberts, as late as last summer, have said this, that nothing about our decision today in Heller should prevent legislatures, state and federal, from imposing reasonable restrictions and other conditions on the ownership and use of weapons. And they go on to describe the kinds of things that legislatures can, in fact, do to impose restrictions and conditions on the use, the transfer, the manufacture, the sale, the ownership of weapons in America. And so when we think about the Supreme Court, in these cases, Heller and Bruin, Heller announcing not only the right to gun ownership in the home, Bruin expanding that onto the streets of America, but also affirming along the way that the Second Amendment also conveys something else, which is a confirmation that those guns, that those firearms that are used and are accessed by Americans legitimately, constitutionally, that all of that is also subject to reasonable and rational restrictions and controls in America. And why is that? Why does the Supreme Court say all that? It is because, at core, the Supreme Court is also concerned, as we all are, as our federal legislature is, as our state legislature is, concerned about safety and security. And that gun ownership and gun use, the manufacture, the transfer, the use of all of the guns that we have in America, also comes with it responsibility. And that responsibility means along the way that legislatures have not only the prerogative, but I would offer to you the view of a majority of Americans, an overwhelming majority of Americans, that guns in America should come with them, not only that responsibility for responsible use, but also legislative action to ensure that people who should not have guns should not have guns. And that is what we are lacking in many states throughout our union, and also lacking from the federal Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. We know that 4 in 10 U.S. adults say that they live in a house with a gun, including 30% who say they personally own one. That comes out of Pew Research. Personal protection tops the list of reasons why gun owners say they own a firearm. That's also a part of the general demographic of gun ownership in America. We also know, however, that about half of Americans, 50% or so, see gun violence as what's described as a very big problem in the country. This is not a fringe issue. This is not one of those situations where a small number of our population feels strongly about something. Just to the contrary, at least 50% of our nation believes that this is a huge problem in our nation. And indeed, roughly half of Americans, 53%, favor stricter gun laws. Again, gun laws that can, in fact, be imposed under Heller, under Bruin, according to the United States Supreme Court, implicit, if not explicit, in our Second Amendment jurisprudence. We know all of that, that even in the midst of the horrific nature of gun violence in our country, a majority of our population feels strongly that the legislatures of our nation and of our states should do something to address the issue and to ensure that the almost 50,000 people who were killed by gun-related injuries in 2021, that those numbers are not repeated in 2023 and going forward. When we come back, we're going to talk about those things that our legislatures at the federal level and the state level can, in fact, do in response to the support by a majority of Americans to address this terrible problem that we have in America. Join us for our final segment as we talk about the remedies, known remedies, for gun violence in our nation.
In good times that I know, you know. Well, I said I just got to know them. It isn't what she's got to say, or how she thinks or where she's been. To me, the words are nice, the way they sound.
Ready for a journey to Flavortown? Head over to Roadhouse 66 Gas and Grill. They've been serving up the best food in Wrigleyville for 8 years and counting. From their famous smoked chicken wings to their tempura battered cheese curds, every bite is a trip to flavor heaven. And with hospitality that's second to none, you'll feel right at home. So why wait until after the game? Rev up your taste buds and join them at Roadhouse 66 Gas and Grill at 3478 North Clark Street in Chicago. Check out their menu on Facebook.
Don't Don't settle for big box service and pricing when it comes to your flooring. Choose Straight Edge Flooring for quality and personalized service. A family-owned flooring company, they offer full-service flooring solutions from material to install, including on-site dust-free refinishing. Straight Edge Flooring installers are CFI certified and fully insured, with free in-home consultations to simplify your project. Choose Straight Edge Flooring. Log on straightedgewi.com. That's straightedgewi.com. Or call 414-779-8931 and make your vision a reality.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Overcast this afternoon with scattered rain showers likely. High temperatures reach up to 41. Winds out of the west, 10 to 15 miles an hour. Cloudy skies expected tonight. A mixture of precipitation likely. Lows dip down to about 33. A mixture of precipitation likely. Tomorrow, high temperatures reach up to 42. A dusting of snow tonight through tomorrow. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 37 degrees.
A progressive voice from Beaver Dam to Kenosha. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
We are back for this final segment, a sobering final segment, talking about guns in America. In addition to all of those mass shootings that we have known about, we have seen with such regularity in America, we know that in recent weeks we've also had these horrific cases where significant events have happened involving the loss of life. We know about the case involving young Ralph Yawl, who's a 16-year-old young man in Kansas City, Missouri, went to pick up his younger twin brothers at a friend's house on an evening in Kansas City, mixed up the address, found himself in front of the house on a terrace street as opposed to another street that he should have, in fact, been at, and lost his life because the person who responded, the homeowner at that time, a fellow named Andrew Lester, shot him. Ralph did not lose his life at the time. He was taken to the hospital, suffered some very serious injuries, and is now recovering. Again, that kind of thing where guns are becoming the mechanism for conflict resolution, even not conflict resolution. It is the reaction to an unknown thing. We know that in New York, in the same week, a young woman was in fact killed. A 20-year-old was killed when she happened to drive up the wrong driveway in a New York rural area. A cheerleader was shot, again, not killed, but shot in a grocery store when she approached the wrong car there. And again, in North Carolina, there were shots fired when a basketball rolled into a wrong neighborhood, an adjacent property in a particular neighborhood there. Young Ralph Yawl continues to recuperate from his injuries that have been the subject of so much attention recently, even as the homeowner there, Ralph Andrew Lester, is the subject of charges for that misuse of guns. All of that indicating, again, that guns are a major problem in our country, not only with respect to mass shootings, but also these singular events of mistaken events where they become the mechanisms for conflict resolution, not conflict resolution. What do we do about all this? What do we do about it? Well, we know, in fact, again, by virtue of the Supreme Court's decisions in Heller and Bruin, that you can, in fact, legitimately, constitutionally impose upon our communities reasonable, rational restrictions that keep things like the Ralph Yawl situation happening in the future, keep these mass shootings from occurring at the speed and the ferocity that they are, at least trying to reduce them in some significant way. Let's talk about some of the things that you can do that can be done at the legislative level, both at the state level and also in the federal system. Some things that have, in fact, been accomplished in some states and the good things that have come from this. Let's talk, first of all, about background checks, requiring comprehensive universal background checks on all gun sales would undeniably decrease gun violence in Wisconsin and in other places around the country. Now, what are they? What are background checks? Well, we know that federally licensed firearm dealers are required by federal law, gun shops, to conduct a background check on gun buyers through something called the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, something called the NICS system. And if a buyer is prohibited from purchasing a gun for any reason, the system alerts the dealer not to sell to that individual that firearm. They're quick, they're easy, they're secure, and they're accurate. And 92% of all Americans support background checks on gun sales. So why do we need those? Well, universal background checks are necessary when licensed dealers are required to run these background checks on buyers. But there's a huge loophole, and that is for unlicensed dealers. Online or gun shows, they do not perform those background checks there. This private sale loophole allows just about anybody to buy a gun with no background check, no identification, no questions asked, and basically permitting millions of people, including those ineligible to purchase firearms, who would otherwise be prohibited from doing so in a properly licensed shop or other circumstance, permits them to buy from unlicensed dealers and exploit that private sale loophole. And so we know that background checks are effective in those states that have implemented them. We know that the gun violence rate has gone down. For example, in 10 years following Connecticut's passage of its law requiring prospective gun buyers to get a permit by passing a background check, firearm homicides declined by 40% there. Background checks at the federal level here in Wisconsin would remedy this problem that we have. In Wisconsin, we believe that 80% of people want background checks on all guns. That, according to a 2019 Marquette Law School poll. And beyond that, we know that 81% of Wisconsinites also support something called the Extreme Risk Protection or Protective Orders. What are they? What are ERPOs? ERPOs give families and law enforcement authorities a way to ask a judge to temporarily, not permanently, prohibit and ask an at-risk person from purchasing or possessing a gun. It's a non-criminal process that involves a court hearing and clearly defining the parameters by which someone who might pose a risk to themselves or to other people, defining the parameters under which that person should have a gun. If you're a family member, if you're concerned about someone, you approach a judge, a law enforcement authority, and say, here's the basis for my belief that this person may in fact pose a risk. And the judge, in his or her determination, can make a temporary decision to remove that gun from that person who might pose a risk of danger to themselves or to other people. They are especially effective in preventing suicides and, yes, indeed, mass shootings. How many times have we heard situations where family members come back later on and say, I have known about this situation? ERPOs can save lives. And we know, once again, that in those states where these kinds of extreme protection order processes, constitutionally effective, constitutionally implemented, have been passed by legislatures, that they preserve life and they keep us more safe and secure. We know as well that domestic and intimate partner violence prohibitions also have an impact upon guns in America. More than half of all intimate partner homicides are committed with a gun. We know as well that transgender people are 1.7 times more likely than cisgender individuals to experience intimate partner violence. 4.5 million women have been threatened with a gun by an intimate partner. What do we know? We know that states that require people to surrender guns when they are subject to an intimate partner violence restraining order, a regular restraining order that keeps them safe and secure from other people, safe and secure from their violence, nearly lower the intimate partner homicide rate significantly over those states that do not. All of these kinds of things and more. The domestic and intimate partner violence legislation, ERPOs, background checks, all of those would make us more safe and secure. I want to talk more about all this in future shows here in Morning Cannolis, even as we continue to address this problem in America. Stay with us for those discussions and continue to engage in advocacy to our legislatures about ways in which guns can be addressed in America to ensure that we are all more safe and secure here in all the states of our country and here in the state of Wisconsin as well. Thank you once again for joining me this day, April 29th, 2023. Come back again down the road.
Everyone deserves freedom over their own body. Everyone deserves the right to choose. Everyone deserves access to quality, affordable health care without judgment. And everyone deserves a health care provider who stands firm on these beliefs. This is the Planned Parenthood experience at any one of our 22 health centers across Wisconsin that offer reproductive health care services for everyone. Book your appointment today at ppwi.org. That's ppwi.org, and get the care you deserve, because we will provide that care no matter what.
Todos merecen la libertad sobre su propio cuerpo. Todo el mundo merece el derecho a elegir. Todos merecen acceso a una atención médica económica y de calidad sin juicios. Y todos merecen un proveedor de atención médica que se mantenga firme en estas creencias. Esta es la experiencia de Planned Parenthood en cualquiera de nuestros 22 centros de salud en Wisconsin, que ofrecen servicios de salud reproductiva para todos. Haz una cita hoy.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.